Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got some current events. We're checking in on celebrities. We've got some royal news and, of course, plenty of politics. We're going to start with a follow-up of a story from last week. Diane Keaton's family reveals her cause of death. In a statement issued to People, the family of Diane Keaton, who died October 11th at the age of 79, has revealed that the Oscar winner died of pneumonia. This is just a Vanity Fair article published on October 16th. Diane Keaton's unexpected death on Saturday, October 11th, at the age of 79, sent shockwaves through the world. When the news broke, a spokesperson for the Keaton's family released a statement saying there were no further details available at this time and asking for privacy in this moment of great sadness. 4 days later, Keaton's family has broken the silence, revealing Keaton's cause of death. The Keaton family are very grateful for the extraordinary messages of love and support they've received these past few days on behalf of their beloved Diane, who passed away from pneumonia on October 11th, reads a statement sent to People. Keaton had kept a low profile in recent years, preferring to lead her life far from the spotlight, holed up in her California villa. Her health declined very suddenly, a friend told People on October 11th. In her final months, she was surrounded by only her closest family, who chose to keep things very private. Even longtime friends weren't fully aware of what was happening, the same source said. She loved her animals, and she was steadfast in her support of the unhoused community, continues the statement from Keaton's family. Any donations in her memory to a local food bank or an animal shelter would be a wonderful and much appreciated tribute to her. Keaton leaves behind a cinematic legacy spanning several decades. Her career was marked by her titular role in Woody Allen's Annie Hall, a film inspired by their past romance, which won her the Oscar for Best Actress in 1977. Keaton established herself as a film icon with indelible roles in Francis Ford Coppola's Godfather trilogy, Warren Beatty's 1981 drama Reds, Charles Shire's 1991 romantic comedy Father of the Bride, and Nancy Meyers' 2003 romantic comedy Something's Gotta Give. Over the course of her life, Keaton had a number of famous romances with stars including Allen, Beatty, and her godfather husband, Al Pacino. However, she preferred to lead the life of a single woman. I don't think it would have been a good idea for me to have married, and I'm really glad I didn't, she declared to People in 2019. She leaves behind two children, Dexter and Duke, whom she adopted in 1996 and 2001. In other celebrity news, Brigitte Bardot is in a worrying state after a three-week hospital stay. The French icon reportedly underwent surgery for a serious illness in Toulon. This is by Alicia Ferry on October 17th. Brigitte Bardot, icon of French cinema, recently underwent major surgery at the private Saint-Jean Hospital in Toulon, not far from her home in La Madrague, Saint-Tropez. According to a local newspaper, Var Matin, the actress was admitted to the hospital 3 weeks ago and underwent surgery there as part of a serious illness. Though the details were not confirmed officially, the 91-year-old actress is reportedly in a worrying state, though there is some optimism for her recovery. She may be discharged from the hospital should her post-surgery continue smoothly. This is not the first time that Bardot has had to deal with major health problems. In January 2023, she was hospitalized due to respiratory failure that later resolved. Little news has been heard about her since then. In 1973, Bardot retired from the industry after decades as one of the world's most desired actresses. She was also a regular presence in the nightlife of her beloved French Riviera. After her debut as a model, Bardot made 45 films and recorded 70 songs. She ended her public career to make way for a second life dedicated to environmentalism and the protection of animals, which she carries out throughout the global charity foundation Brigitte Bardot. A symbol of the era's changing standards of beauty, she also became a stand-in for women's emancipation. Her peak popularity in the 1960s and 70s coincided with the feminist awakening that would take streets and screens around the world. Only a few weeks ago, Bardot released her latest book, Beder, a memoir that recounts her life from A to Z, lining up anecdotes, thoughts, feelings, and struggles. More from Hollywood. Apple Martin knows she's privileged. This is not a normal way to grow up. My parents did a really good job of instilling in me that I shouldn't be entitled to anything. I have to work, says the model and student. This is by Marita Alonso on October 17th. Being the daughter of Chris Martin and Gwyneth Paltrow might make it difficult for onlookers to see you as your own person. Apple Martin, who just posed with her mother for Gap, knows this all too well. But she also has her own connection to the brand. When I think of Gap, I think of growing up with it, she said in a statement as the store launched its new campaign. When I was little, I was always dressed in Gap Kids, and I've loved clothes since I was that age. Martin is also the image of Self Portrait, a brand that has become a favorite Gen Z thanks to campaigns with big names like Phoebe Dynevor and Gigi Hadid. In an interview with The Telegraph, Martin explains that as a child, she would do fashion shows in her room, dressed in her school uniform and posing in front of the mirror as if she were on a catwalk. She still loves to look at her mother's past on the red carpet. And, of course, she occasionally borrows accessories and garments from Paltrow's closet. She keeps a lot of things. Not all of them fit me, but the ones that do fit me, I always steal. I recently stole a Prada bowling bag from her. It's the perfect travel bag because it fits so much, she says. When Martin doesn't have a fashion campaign on her hands, she studies law, history, and society at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. I constantly remind myself how grateful I am to have these opportunities, she told the newspaper. I know this is not a normal way to grow up by any means, but my parents did a really good job of instilling in me that I shouldn't be entitled to anything. I have to work. Also in the celebrity category, Monica Lewinsky explains how her collaboration with Flamingo Estate is about healing. In honor of National Bullying Prevention Month, the anti-bullying activist has joined forces with the beloved lifestyle and wellness brand. This is by Monica Lewinsky on October 16th. October is National Bullying Prevention Month. For many years, I've done anti-bullying PSA campaigns to contribute to the discourse, but truth be told, it was hard to find a way in 2025 that didn't feel too earnest or treacly. Sadly, we still see bullying behavior everywhere. If it isn't the FCC bullying Jimmy Kimmel, it's LGBTQ plus rights under attack. And even Kanye West's forthcoming album, Bully. What could I do this fucking year that didn't feel tone deaf, but somehow help? In early September, I texted Richard Christensen, founder of lifestyle and wellness brand Flamingo Estate, to ask him if, like some recent collaborations, Pamela Anderson's pickles, Laura Dern's olive oil, and LeBron James' honey, we could join forces on a candle in support of National Bullying Prevention Month with a small portion of the proceeds benefiting some anti-bullying organizations. Candles have always been something that helped me ground and find my center, especially in tough times. I burn them daily in my home as a reminder of warmth, and the fragrance transports me. I travel with candles, gift them often, yes, even after I read that hosts often think a candle has been regifted, and always have one lit near my bath. But more than anything, candles symbolize a light in the dark. I love that idea. God knows I had enough bullying at school, Christensen replied in the seconds. And no, not a small portion of the proceeds. All of the proceeds can go to the charities. Yes, get yourself a friend like Richard Christensen. While I was initially flattered that Christensen had responded so quickly to me, although in case you forgot, I am charming after all, I came to learn there was a deeper meaning behind the enthusiasm. Growing up in rural Australia, one of two boys raised by farmer parents, Christensen experienced incessant bullying at school. I was a soft, gentle, gay kid who grew up in a very hyper-masculine sort of rural world. My dad sent us to a school that had a cadet-like program, I think to toughen us up, he explained over the phone. I was very aware that I was just not like the other boys. My brother and I both were bullied pretty heavily all the way through high school. And so the idea behind Flamingo Estate's newest candle, Blossoming Camellia, materialized. It combines white camellia, lemon, vanilla, and a little bit of clove for a fresh but spicy scent. As promised, proceeds are in support of four global anti-bullying organizations, the Tyler Clementi Foundation and Hetrick Martin Institute in the U.S., the Diana Awards Anti-Bullying Program in the U.K., and Project Rocket in Australia. All of these organizations help young people who are being bullied and teach their peers how to avoid bystander behavior. According to the American Society for the Positive Care of Children, or the SPCC, when bystanders intervene, bullying stops within 10 seconds, 57% of the time. But even before my idea, Christensen, who describes himself as a huge believer that the universe is pushing us together and weaving with these silent, invisible strings, was already writing a chapter on camellias for a forthcoming book. The main thing is, it's not the quarterback flower. It's not a sunflower. It's not a rose. It's not one of these summer flowers that blooms in summer and needs a hummingbird and needs the bees, he explained over the phone. Camellias bloom on their own time, in their own way, and they often bloom in the dark. Camellias bloom on their own time, in their own way, and they often bloom in the dark. This notion is familiar to me. The very reason I became an activist was because after a long period of bullying, hiding, and healing, being in a presidential political scandal will do that to ya, I reemerged in a first-person essay for this magazine in 2014 titled Shame and Survival. The night before it published, I was a morass of nerves and trepidation. One of my closest friends gave me a card with an encouraging Anne Nin quote, and the day came when the risk to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom. Was it kismet that Christensen and I both found strength in the teachings of the natural world? Maybe. Also, the history of the camellia in California is very layered, Christensen went on to say, largely promoted by Japanese-American farmers who were on the receiving end of terrible discrimination during the war. They ended up selling their farms and their land at massive discounts and were forbidden from buying property for such a long time. But yet, they were the backbone of farming in California before the war, and to continue to face such discrimination, which is a form of bullying, for so long. So there's a number of coexisting narratives with the camellia that I love. I have the opposite of a green thumb. I once killed a cactus in 3 days, but before Christensen and I hung up, he talked to me about another natural wonder, thin-skinned fruit. Something I must admit I'd never thought about before in my life, but perhaps a metaphor for where we find ourselves now. According to the SPCC, 70.6% of young people say they have witnessed bullying at school, and I know as a highly sensitive person, it's not been easy these days. Now that all of our food and produce is shipped across the world, which is a terrible thing, we lost anything that was soft-skinned. The idea that you would want to have the same tomato in Mexico as I would love to have in Miami, that you would love to have in Minneapolis, makes no sense, he said. I think it's the same. The same is true of people. We need to celebrate the differences of each other so that we don't all end up being exactly the same. And so that uniqueness of thin-skinned fruit and thin-skinned people, I think, is really precious. It's great to have people who feel things deeply, imagine things deeply, and dream deeply. All those thin-skinned qualities, I think, are something that we should encourage. I do too, Richard. I do too. We have another memoriam this week. D'Angelo made Neo-Soul a document of Black life in America. The talented artist and reluctant sex symbol made music that wasn't just enjoyable, it was ambitious. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on October 15th. Michael Eugene Archer, the singer and musician better known as D'Angelo, had no use for neo-soul, the label critics used to describe the type of music he helped personify, in the 1990s and 2000s. I never claimed I do neo-soul, he said in 2014. I make black music. D'Angelo, who died of pancreatic cancer on Tuesday at the age of 51, certainly did. His music helped define what it meant to be black at a time when it meant when that meaning was in flux, an age where some African-American intellectuals feared that their community's most popular cultural export, rap, was overly coarse and primitive. Over three incomparable albums, Brown Sugar from 1995, Voodoo from 2000, and Black Messiah from 2014, D'Angelo made art that was unquestionably black in its embrace of gospel's history, as well as its experimentation and radicalism. From the Bill Clinton impeachment scandal to Woodstock 99, the late 1990s left many Americans worried that culture was going down the drain. But the neo-soul movement now stands out as a vibrant and meaningful counterexample. Made by bohemians with a social conscience and remarkable skill, their music wasn't just enjoyable, it was ambitious. D'Angelo worked with, inspired, and paved the way for a mind-boggling list of musicians, including Questlove and The Roots, DJ Premier, Raphael Sadiq, Erykah Badu, Maxwell, Lauryn Hill, and Angie Stone. Stone, D'Angelo's former partner and the mother of his son, died earlier this year in a tragic car crash. In hindsight, it's pleasantly surprising that they all enjoyed so much critical and commercial success during their creative peaks. If soul music is made for falling in love, D'Angelo made music for people who were trying to live together, however uneasily. Voodoo was one of the things that could easily soothe a restive black family gathering in the early 2000s, getting the hateration and holleration to stop for at least 79 minutes, as older generations gave millennials a lesson about good music. Despite the explicit sticker prominently displayed on the CD jewel case and profane guest appearances from Redman and Method Man, even respectable members of the Greatest Generation could find something to love in that album, thanks to D'Angelo's knowledgeable interpretations of the blues. For someone whose best known contribution to the cultural conversation is a video in which he appears to be, but actually isn't, entirely naked, D'Angelo's music was also surprisingly churchy. He was raised in a devoutly Pentecostal family in Richmond, Virginia, and during his teen years, he played the organ at the church where his father preached. His music is full of the vamping and intensifying one expects to hear during a particularly pleasurable hour at a black church, and the call and response motif common in the spirituals that grew out of work songs. His transcendent hit, Untitled, How Does It Feel?, the song illustrated by that classic music video, feels more like a hymn than a pop song, even if it's clearly sung in praise of the body. That conflict makes it painfully ironic that D'Angelo is still so associated with the single's intensely sexy video, even though sex symbol wasn't a mantle he felt comfortable seizing. Mark Jenkins, the trainer who helped D'Angelo transform his physique for the video, told Spin magazine in 2008 that the recreation came as a shock to the musician. To be someone who was so introverted and then, in a matter of 3 or 4 months, to be so ripped, everything was happening so quickly. Look at the work and you'll see why D'Angelo wasn't comfortable with the label of neo-soul. Marketing language can often fail to capture what art really is. Now that his music is no longer new, maybe we can just call it soul and add D'Angelo to a long list of artists who have transformed difficult lives into emotive examples of black expression. Sam Cooke, Otis Redding, Curtis Mayfield, Marvin Gaye, all of them are gone. Now D'Angelo and Stone are too. Who could look at that list and not be struck by the sheer number of artists on it who were taken too soon? This next article is going to segue us into the royal section. Prince William and Gisele Bündchen join forces for a climate campaign in Brazil. Kate Blanchett, Queen Rania of Jordan, and Sir David Attenborough have also supported the royal in his fight for environmental change. This is by Seraphine Roger on October 13th. Prince William has added a supermodel to his delegation of eco-friendly spokespeople. None other than Brazilian fashion mogul Gisele Bündchen has joined the board of the Earthshot Prize, the initiative of King Charles III's son, supporting inventions for the environment and sustainability. Guided by her love for her family, community, and nature, Gisele has long inspired millions with her vision and commitment to positive change. A statement on the official initiative Instagram read, emphasizing the value of Bündchen's leadership as well as her dedication that will be invaluable to Brazil and beyond. Honored to join the movement, Bündchen renewed her pledge to be a spokesperson for the protection of nature, a cause that has long been close to her heart. I've seen the power of global communities coming together and supporting innovation to create real change, she said in a statement shared with People. The Earthshot Award highlights solutions that inspire hope and transformation, and I'm proud to represent Brazil by sharing these stories with the world. The model joins a host of other celebrities who have advocated for the cause, including two-time Oscar winner Kate Blanchett, Queen Rania of Jordan, and British journalist
Sir David Attenborough. By accepting this role, the 14 members of the council commit themselves to promoting positive action in favor of the environment. Their votes also count in determining the five winners of the Earthshot Prize, awarded each autumn under the chairmanship of Christiana Figueres. Bunchen's nomination comes just a month and a half before the Earthshot Prize ceremony, which would be held in Rio de Janeiro on November 5th. The red carpet is already shaping up to be glamorous. The Prince of Wales has announced that he will be attending, but the presence of his wife, Kate Middleton, has not yet been announced. The fifth edition of the Earthshot Prize is crucial in Prince William's eyes, as it falls midway between the proposed start and end dates of the initiative, launched in 2020 for a 10-year period. Scientists made it clear that we need to make significant changes by 2030, he recalled in a short video shared in early October, filmed at the foot of the oak tree that helped inspire the idea for the Earthshot Prize. Back then, a decade seemed a long time. George was 7, Charlotte 5, and Louis 2. Imagining them in 2030 seemed like an eternity, Prince William continued. But today, when we're halfway through this crucial decade, 2030 feels very real. In other royal news, Prince Andrew is officially dropping his Duke of York title after new Epstein revelations. His ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, will officially cease the use of the Duchess of York, but his two daughters will not be affected. This is by Katie Nicholl on October 17th. Prince Andrew has agreed to give up his royal titles to save the royal family from further embarrassment over his connections with convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Though he took a step back from his role as a senior royal in November 2019, he has continued to use the Duke of York title that was conferred by Queen Elizabeth II on his wedding day in 1986. The prince shared the news in a statement issued through Buckingham Palace on Friday, adding that he consulted King Charles III in the course of making his decision. I stand by my decision 5 years ago to stand back from public life, it read. With His Majesty's agreement, we feel I must now go a step further. I will therefore no longer use my title or the honors which have been conferred upon me. Though his accuser, Virginia Giuffre, died by suicide earlier this year, her allegations have resurfaced in a memoir that's due to be published on October 21st. In his statement, Andrew continued to deny all claims of impropriety. As I have said previously, I vigorously deny the accusations against me, the statement read. In discussion with the king and my immediate and wider family, we have concluded the continued accusations about me distract from the work of His Majesty and the royal family. I have decided, as I always have, to put my duty to my family and country first. It is understood that the prince agreed to give up his remaining royal titles amid mounting pressure over his links with Epstein and an alleged Chinese spy. The king, who has been at a loss over how to deal with what is known as the Andrew problem at the palace, is said to be glad of the outcome. Along with other members of the royal family, Prince William, who has privately been concerned about the optics of Prince Andrew retaining his titles and being seen as close to the royal family, was consulted. Sources say the decision for Andrew to give up his titles was taken in close deliberation with the king and in recognition of the fact that the prince's personal issues continue to distract from the work of the wider royal family. It is understood that the king appealed to Prince Andrew, who still lives at Royal Lodge on the Windsor Estate, to do the right thing and give up his titles in order to preserve the reputation of the monarchy. Sarah Ferguson will also give up her title as Duchess of York, according to a source with knowledge. She will continue to be known as Sarah Ferguson, as she has been for matters of business since her divorce from Andrew in 1996. Princess Beatrice and Princess Eugenie are blood princesses and will retain the use of their titles. Palace aides have said that the king is fond of his nieces, who will be wholly unaffected by the changes to Sarah and Andrew's titles. Andrew was stripped of his royal patronages and military titles in January 2022, though he continued to appear at public events with the royal family and participate in certain ceremonies. Having been born the son of Queen Elizabeth II, he will remain a prince, but along with the Duke of York title, he will also give up his membership in the Order of the Garter. Buckingham Palace has said the change to his titles will come into effect immediately, and Andrew will not join the royal family for the traditional Christmas church service and celebrations. Andrew's connections to Epstein became a matter of public controversy when the pair were photographed walking in Central Park in 2010, but the royal only stepped back from his public role in 2019 after he gave an interview to BBC's Newsnight in which he denied the allegations but failed to show empathy for Epstein's victims. In August 2021, Giuffre filed a civil sexual assault lawsuit against him in the U.S., and it was settled in February 2022. The prince denied allegations that he had sexual relations with Giuffre when she was 17. In recent days, the pressure has mounted for the palace to take decisive action over Andrew, who will continue to live at Royal Lodge, where he has a private tenancy agreement with the Crown Estate. A recent YouGov poll showed that 67% of the British public want Andrew to be fully stripped of his royal titles, which would require the British government's involvement. In the infamous Newsnight interview, Andrew claimed that he had cut off all contact with Epstein in 2010, but new reports suggest that he had continued to correspond with the convicted pedophile. This weekend, multiple news outlets published excerpts from an email the prince wrote to Epstein in 2011 after a photograph appeared of him with his arm around Giuffre in a British newspaper. One email, which was revealed as a part of a legal case earlier this year, showed Andrew taking a casual tone. "It would seem we're in this together and we'll have to rise above it," it read, per UK's The Times. "Otherwise, keep in close touch and we'll play some more soon." Next in the Royals section, do you have what it takes to join King Charles's staff? The Royals are looking to fill a pivotal role at Sandringham Estate, the Norfolk home where they usually spend Christmas. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on October 16th. An unusual job is opened up at Sandringham Estate, perfect for an entrepreneurial royal watcher. The estate announced last week that it's hiring for a pivotal role, marketing manager. Located in Norfolk, Sandringham is the country retreat where King Charles III invites his family to spend the Christmas holidays, following a tradition begun by his mother, Queen Elizabeth II. But it is also a tourist attraction with more than 200 employees. The estate has laid out a few of the qualifications it hopes to find in its ideal candidate. In a job description, it also says, "You'll blend creativity with data-driven insight, working cross-functionally to ensure our story is told compellingly across all channels, from digital campaigns and PR to on-site signage and seasonal brochures." In a document with a photo of the king kneeling down in a poppy field, the estate emphasizes that communication is one of its main values. "We talk, listen, and learn from each other," it says. Though Downton Abbey tends to be our touchstone for what it might be like to work for the British aristocracy, modern-day employees of royals have much more freedom and flexibility. Though there are still butlers and valets, the Windsors have been working to modernize their operations since the 1950s. Nowadays, the palace has plenty of office workers and even a cybersecurity team. The royal family's focus on efficiency is also filtered down to the private properties the family opens to the public for special occasions. Earlier this month, Sandringham Estate also posted an advertisement seeking a new chef to join its catering department. The ideal candidate will be responsible for preparing high-quality meals, maintaining kitchen standards, and the highest standards of service, reads the job description on the Sandringham Estate website, which adds that the position will require knowledge of and interest in many styles of food and service. The chef, who will be responsible for preparing menus for special events, will also need to take a calm approach to dealing with complaints and disputes. Though this role might seem more at home in a Julian Fellows show, there's one very modern addition to the job requirements. The ideal chef candidate must also have basic IT skills as well as good numeric skills. Before we move into the politics section, I'm just going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. And today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We are going into the politics section, which is also current events, of course. And our first headline is "Never Surrender. No Kings takes on special urgency in Chicago." "We love America. We love Chicago. Donald Trump, stay the hell out of our city," said J.B. Pritzker from the event, which drew an estimated 100,000 protesters. This is by Eric Lutz on October 19th. It was an unseasonably warm fall day in Chicago as an estimated 100,000 demonstrators descended on Grant Park for the second No Kings protest of 2025. For more than a month, the city has been at the center of Donald Trump's constitution-defying immigration crackdown. But on Saturday, there was a sense of catharsis, because at least for one afternoon, there was somewhere for all the pent-up fear, angst, and outrage of liberal-leaning Chicagoans to go. Demonstrators packed the park with signs denouncing ICE, which has functioned like an extra legal force here since Trump's so-called Operation Midway began in September. Masked state agents have been pulling people into unmarked vans, conducting raids in school pickup lines and churches and apartment buildings, and responding with violence to protests. "Stop the kidnapping," one sign read. "Chicago bows to No King," read another. No Kings, the second such anti-Trump demonstration in recent months, drew an estimated 7 million into the streets of cities and towns across the country, its organizers said Saturday, reportedly making it one of the largest single-day protests in United States history. But with the president targeting Chicago, Trump outright suggested he was declaring war on the defiantly blue city as he launched his ICE operation. "The mobilization here and the surrounding suburbs took on a particular urgency. They want a rematch of the Civil War, but we're here to stand firm," Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson told the crowd Saturday. "We will never surrender," added Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who has emerged as one of Trump's most formidable antagonists, as well as a possible Democratic contender in 2028. "We love America. We love Chicago. Donald Trump, stay the hell out of our city." In the lead-up to Saturday's mass protests, Trump and his Republican allies had likened the demonstrations to acts of violent treason. "Hate America rallies," as House Speaker Mike Johnson dubbed them. Some suggested Antifa, the loosely defined left-wing movement. Trump labeled the terrorist organization in the wake of Charlie Kirk's murder, was behind it all. Texas Governor Greg Abbott announced late last week that he would call the National Guard to Austin in response. But the protests came across all 50 states, much like at the first No Kings in June and the hands-off protests in April, were overwhelmingly peaceful and upbeat, frequently infused with a kind of absurdist humor designed to undercut the administration's portrayal of protesters as violent insurgents and their cities as dystopian hellholes. Chicago's event expressed the city's distinct municipal pride. There was a guy dressed up as the Chicago-raised Pope Leo XIV, wearing a cassock and white Sox cap. Another wore a Bears jersey and a tricorner hat. At least one sign deemed the president a Chicago-certified jagoff. "I guess it's hope," one 20-something demonstrator told me as we took in the massive crowd. "A lot of people care." Trump has operated over the past 9 months with the pretense of a mandate as he reshapes American political culture in his image. But the No Kings demonstration served as a reminder that no such mandate exists, that his victory nearly a year ago was not a blank check, and that he's executing much of his agenda without popular support. That's important to keep in mind as Indivisible co-founder Ezra Levin, one of the organizers of the No Kings protest, told me. "Authoritarian regimes thrive on a sense of powerlessness," Levin said by phone. "They want you to feel like they're all powerful. They want you to feel that it's pointless to try to organize against them because you don't have the power." The demonstration wasn't just about pushing back on Trump. It was about beating back cynicism and nihilism and fatalism, Levin said. "You stand up to show that it is indeed possible to push back against this regime, that the current moment that we're in is not forever." Republicans have pivoted from fear-mongering to downplaying the demonstrations, with Johnson dismissing them as a stunt on ABC News Sunday morning. But the mobilization appeared to provoke Trump, who responded to protesters' discontent with a bizarre AI-generated video of himself wearing a crown and dumping feces from a fighter jet onto protesters. What remains to be seen, of course, is if this anti-Trump energy can be translated into real political action. Democrats are still shut out of power in Washington and continue to lack a cohesive vision beyond their opposition to Trump. We've seen leaders in charge not deliver on kitchen table issues that matter, and we have to change that. Mashara Davis, Director of Issue and Electoral Organizing at the nonpartisan State Voices, part of the coalition behind No Kings, told me. This No Kings protest is one way in which we can really bring the change that we're hoping to see to the community. Our next headline, Donald Trump absolutely loves attention. So does James Comey. The former FBI director just wouldn't yield the stage, which is surely one reason he drives Trump so crazy. This is by Chris Smith on October 15th. The move was classic James Comey. The former director of the FBI was due at a courthouse in Alexandria, Virginia at 10 a.m. to be arraigned on charges brought by a federal prosecutor who had been handpicked by President Donald Trump and was following his orders. The appearance was a formality, but Comey used it to send a message. Comey showed up in the courtroom more than 20 minutes before the scheduled start of the hearing, arriving before the prosecution team or the judge. Maybe Comey had simply found a good parking spot, but his early entrance commanded the full attention of the assembled reporters. On one hand, Comey was projecting innocence and fortitude. "I have nothing to fear. Let's get started." On the other hand, Comey was once again saying, "Look at me." The tension between rectitude and ego has been at the core of Comey's public career for decades. It shaped his choices, most infamously, in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election when Comey, in his very public handling of the Hillary Clinton email server investigation, may have helped Trump win. Putting himself at the center of that mess set in motion the tangled chain of events that eventually made Comey a prime target of Trump's anger and now retribution at the hands of his politicized Department of Justice. Comey's role in the 2016 election drama, plus the enormous legal and constitutional stakes of his impending trial, have made him the second most consequential FBI director in American history, after J. Edgar Hoover. "You could certainly make that case," says Beverly Gage, who wrote G-Man, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Hoover. When Comey was FBI director, he was more public and more interesting, even before Trump came along, than some of his predecessors, and more comfortable in the public eye. Now that he's come to not only be a household name, but to represent a certain set of political conflicts. Comey's prominence seems both accidental and inexorable. Formative parts of his life, an early fascination with religion, a bizarre and frightening childhood episode in which Comey and his brother faced a gun-toting home invader, the sudden death of his 9-day-old son, left Comey with a deep sense of right and wrong, and of the necessity for him to play an active role in fighting for the good guys. In 2003, when Comey was U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, he told me, "It is our obligation as people not to let evil hold the field, not to let bad win." His victories included the convictions of Martha Stewart for obstruction of justice, among other charges connected to an insider trading case and a telecom executive in a massive fraud scheme. Comey, then a Republican, developed a reputation for affability and independence, and he was soon promoted from New York to Maine Justice in Washington as the number two to then Attorney General John Ashcroft. When Ashcroft became critically ill with pancreatitis, two White House aides went to his hospital bedside to try to get Ashcroft to reauthorize a domestic surveillance program that was expiring the next day. Comey rushed to the hospital to intercede. It was an act of bureaucratic and moral courage, but the episode became public, and Comey, after testifying about it before Congress, was seen as a hero, something that made even some of his allies uncomfortable. "You never want that story told," a prosecutorial colleague from that period says. "That's not the job. The job is protecting your boss and keeping it out of the public eye." Comey's choices and the spotlight were even more glaring in 2016. After an FBI investigation found no basis on which to prosecute Clinton, the Democratic presidential nominee, for her use of a private email server while working as Secretary of State, Comey nevertheless held a press conference during which he blasted Clinton as extremely careless. Then, 11 days before the election, Comey told Congress that the FBI was reopening the probe after Clinton-related emails were discovered on the laptop of former New York Congressman Anthony Weiner. Both moves were boons to Trump's campaign. Yet even though he won in 2016, Trump became enraged by the FBI's investigation into possible Russian meddling in the election. He eventually fired Comey. Trump has never forgiven him. Rather, he spent years spoiling to punish Comey, and the current prosecution is the payoff. Comey's unwillingness to yield the stage is surely part of what drives Trump crazy. He wrote a book, A Higher Loyalty, that was deeply critical of Trump, and he's been a frequent cable news guest and social media commentator. Trump is obsessed with Comey. He's less obsessed with some other people that have arguably wronged him worse. Because Jim is on TV, he's in Trump's sights more, a Comey associate said. Jim is a good man and a good leader, and he's been wrongly tarred as an agent of politics. He's been trying to be relevant and to show he hasn't lost his moral shine all the years since then. The day the indictment was handed down, the 64-year-old Comey released a video in which he declared his innocence and said, "My family and I have known for years that there are costs to standing up to Donald Trump, but we couldn't imagine ourselves living any other way. We will not live on our knees, and you shouldn't either." Once again, Comey was acting admirably, showing the kind of spine that more elected officials should display. He was also once again doing it in a way that made some of his friends cringe, even as they stressed that they're not blaming the victim. A video response to your own indictment posted on Instagram, a former federal prosecutor who worked with Comey says, "I've never seen that, not even from Trump." Which may actually be the genius part. Comey knows that the current battle, like just about everything connected to Trump, is as much a war of public relations as it is of legal tactics. The charges against Comey appear to be flimsy. Yet even if the case never makes it to trial, Trump has scored points by making an example of Comey, something that could intimidate others who might consider standing in the president's way. Comey didn't say much at his arraignment, letting Pat Fitzgerald, his defense lawyer and close friend, enter a not guilty plea on his behalf. But Comey's Instagram post and his early arrival in court were statements of resistance. Last week, after his own indictment by the same federal prosecutor who's going after Comey at Trump's behest, New York Attorney General Letitia James followed the former FBI director's lead by posting a video statement of her innocence, this time on X. "These charges are baseless," James says. "This is the time for leaders on both sides of the aisle to speak out against this blatant perversion of our justice system." However, the FBI's founding director was a master of public relations for most of his career, and he used the Bureau as a weapon, sometimes in service of his boss, the president. But even Hoover did not deal with the kind of relentless White House norm-shattering that has now been turned against Comey. Richard Nixon wanted to politicize the bureaucracy, not just the FBI, but the whole administrative state, in a way Trump has talked about. Gage, the Hoover historian, says, "Nixon tried and failed. It's the closest thing we have, but it's nothing in scale and scope compared to what's happening now." We're moving now to the first of the best 11 reports of the week. This first headline is Rule of Law. Ivanka Trump's former lawyer has a new client, Letitia James. Abby Lowell is representing a growing number of defendants targeted by Donald Trump's DOJ. This is on October 13th. New York Attorney General Letitia James became the latest target of Donald Trump's Justice Department on Thursday when she was charged with one count of bank fraud and one count of making false statements to a financial institution for allegedly claiming a home in Norfolk, Virginia, was her second residence. James has denied the allegations. In a statement, her attorney, Abby Lowell, said the case is being driven by President Trump's desire for revenge and vowed to fight these charges in every process allowed in the law. If the claims against James sound familiar, it's probably because they're very similar to the ones brought against Dr. Lisa Cook, the Fed Board of Governors Trump is trying to oust. And if James' lawyer sounds familiar, it's probably because he also represented Cook. Oh, and his past clients have included Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Herewith, a primer on the go-to defense attorney. Wait. Before we get to Lowell, what's going on with James? James was indicted by a grand jury in Virginia on Thursday and charged with mortgage fraud, having allegedly claimed that a house in Norfolk, Virginia was her second home, which allowed her to obtain more favorable loan terms, but which she rented out. Prosecutors claim James saved $18,933 with the lower interest rate. If convicted, she could face up to 30 years in prison and pay a fine up to $1 million for each count. Similarly, Cook was charged with allegedly claiming two different homes were her private primary residence, allegations she has denied and which appear to be rapidly falling apart. In August, Attorney General Pam Bondi appointed a special attorney to investigate claims against James brought by Federal Housing Finance Agency Director Bill Pulte, who in that same capacity alleged wrongdoing by Cook. After prosecutors concluded they did not have sufficient evidence to win a conviction against James, and the acting U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia resigned under pressure from the president, Trump named one of his former personal attorneys, Lindsay Halligan, as acting prosecutor, despite the fact that she has no prosecutorial experience. In her short time on the job, Halligan first brought charges against former FBI Director James Comey and then James. Good Lord. Good Lord is right. What has James said about all this? In a video posted on X, James, who brought a civil fraud case against Trump that resulted in him being found liable and being barred from running a business in New York for 3 years, declared, "These charges are baseless, and the president's own public statements make clear that his only goal is political retribution at any cost. The president's actions are a grave violation of our constitutional order and have drawn sharp criticism from members of both parties." Then she hired Lowell? Actually, she hired Lowell a number of months ago, and in April, he wrote a letter to A.G. Bondi cautioning her against taking political retribution against James, writing, in part, "I represent New York State Attorney General Letitia James and have reviewed U.S. Federal Housing Director William Pulte's April 14, 2025 letter titled, in bold and italics, Criminal Referral. I write to address the latest act of improper political retribution, this time directed at Ms. James, publicly instigated and endorsed by President Trump. The stunning hypocrisy of President Trump's complaint that the Justice Department has been politicized and weaponized against him is laid bare as he and others in his administration are now asking you to undertake the very same practice. This so-called criminal referral, which recycles long disproven allegations and is based on media reports, lacks any credible foundation. Having one of the president's aides shout to reporters that she is guilty of multiple significant serial criminal and violations is no substitute for the fact." So who else has Lowell represented? After leaving the law firm Winston & Strawn, Lowell started Lowell & Associates earlier this year, where his clients have included numerous targets of the Trump administration. Miles Taylor, the former Homeland Security official and Trump critic, attorney Mark Zaid, who had his security clearance revoked by Trump, DOJ officials fired for working on January 6 cases, a California union leader reportedly arrested while protesting ICE raids, FBI officials who were reportedly fired after conflicts with the administration, Susan Menarez, the CDC director who was fired for not going along with Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy's dangerous changes to vaccine policy. RFK told the Senate he fired her for being untrustworthy. Former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton, who had his house raided by the FBI in August. During an interview in July, Lowell said of his cases, "They all stand for the proposition of something completely unprecedented, which is the full power of the federal government being pointed in the direction of individual people in the United States who happen to be adverse to this administration's policies or who have criticized them. It's extraordinary." Of Bondi, he said, "I don't think there's been an attorney general that has been willing to carry out the president's wrongdoing as much as Pam Bondi has since John Mitchell with President Nixon." Before he started his own firm, Lowell also represented Hunter Biden in the former first son's criminal cases. Biden was convicted for the illegal purchase of a firearm and pleaded guilty to tax evasion. Previous clients have also included, among others, former Democratic Senator Bob Menendez, former U.S. Senator and presidential hopeful John Edwards. He also served as counsel for House Judiciary Committee Democrats during Bill Clinton's 1998 impeachment proceedings. And he was Jared and Ivanka's lawyer too? Sure was. Lowell represented the former first daughter and son-in-law during the investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election, for which the couple was not indicted. It caused a firestorm inside the White House when Jared and Ivanka hired Abby Lowell, but it was smart because you couldn't get a guy who was more dialed into that DC DOJ revolving door and the Democratic establishment, former Trump advisor Stephen Bannon later told the New York Times. This must be awkward for Ivanka, considering that Lowell has said what President Trump and the people who carry out his mandate. It makes George Orwell's 1984 look like a Mother Goose nursery rhyme. I mean, it's just beyond comprehension. Yeah, it must be. To be clear, Lowell is no longer their lawyer. Our next 11 report, Marjorie Taylor Greene sure sounds like she wants to quit the GOP. She certainly doesn't have great things to say about her colleagues. This is on October 16th. In the spring and over the summer, GOP Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene broke with her Republican colleagues on multiple issues, from Donald Trump's spending bill to support for Israel's attacks on Iran. And several months later, the conservative lawmaker is still at it, despite the fact that a large portion of the country could have once easily imagined her starring in an ad attack where she brandished a broken beer bottle and warned Democrats not to fuck with my clique. Earlier this week, Greene told the Washington Post, "There's a lot of weak Republican men in the House, and they're more afraid of strong Republican women," adding that said GOP men always tried to marginalize the strong Republican women that actually want to do something and actually want to achieve. She also accused her male colleagues of jealousy, saying, "They're always intimidated by stronger Republican women because we mean it, and we will do it, and we will make them look bad." Chief among the Republican men on Greene's shit list, her boss, it seems, House Speaker Mike Johnson, whom she sought to oust last year. Greene apparently spent a chunk of last week on the receiving end of angry texts from Johnson over her push for the Senate to abolish the filibuster in order to end the government shutdown. "He told me they can't do it, and it's math," Greene told the Post. "I sent him the article about them doing it yesterday," she added, referring to the Senate's move to change its own rules in order to confirm a group of nominees with just one majority vote. "I said, they just did it." Greene also appeared to suggest that she believes Johnson is sexist toward his female colleagues, claiming that there's a night and day difference in how Johnson and his predecessor, Kevin McCarthy, have treated GOP congresswomen. "McCarthy elevated talented women," Greene said, "and Johnson has pushed them aside." She cited how, in contrast, Trump has filled his cabinet with women, with the Post also noting that, under Johnson, just one GOP congresswoman chairs a committee. There are five female House lawmakers who serve as the top Democrats on committees. Johnson told reporters on Friday that he and Greene had engaged in a good discussion as colleagues and friends. Comments a spokesman referred to when asked by the Post about Greene's claims. As the shutdown is dragged on, Greene has lashed out at fellow Republicans for being unable to come up with a plan to address the expiration of Affordable Care Act subsidies, saying it's ridiculous that more of her colleagues aren't on the same page. "I'm actually representing what a lot of Americans fully support," she told The Hill. She was also just one of four House Republicans to sign a discharge petition seeking to force a vote on releasing the Epstein files in their entirety, a move that prompted Jimmy Kimmel to declare, "You know things in Washington are broken," when Marjorie Taylor Greene is the lone voice of reason on the Republican side. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has been similarly shocked, telling MSNBC of Greene, "It does seem so to many of us that she's had a surprisingly enlightened few weeks." Yet while one anonymous Republican lawmaker told The Hill that Greene has lately been 180 degrees opposite of Trump in her positions, the lawmaker from Georgia does not yet appear ready to abandon the president. While describing many of her House colleagues as weak, she insisted that Trump has a very strong, dominant style. He's not weak at all.
And our last Levin report, New York business leaders are shocked to find out they actually like Zoran Mamdani. He listens, asks questions, is amiable, one admits, but it doesn't mean they'll vote for him. This is on October 15th. After Zoran Mamdani ran away with the Democratic nomination for New York City mayor in June's primary, business leaders across the city lost their collective minds. Billionaire Bill Ackman declared that Mamdani's policies would be disastrous for NYC. Fellow billionaire Daniel Loeb compared Mamdani to Fidel Castro. Venture capitalist Bradley Tusk predicted New York might go the way of Detroit and Baltimore, cities he said had become dirty and dangerous. On CNBC, Jim Cramer wondered if in Mamdani's New York, the rich would get shot. An emergency meeting was held at the pool room about stopping the 33-year-old Democratic socialist, whose name, to some, had become the scariest word du jour. The mere mention of it would send shivers down their spines. At the same time, some business leaders have actually met with Mamdani face-to-face, in private, and come away with the shocking revelation that he's kind of delightful, and they actually like him. Yes, the New York Times reports that over the last few months, a surprising thing has been happening when Mr. Mamdani gets behind closed doors with New York's elite, which is that instead of spitting in their faces or adopting a Mr. Smithers-esque tone while telling them he's going to tax them at 90% and use their penthouses for his city-run grocery stores, he listens, asks questions, and is amiable. And another thing they like? He doesn't lecture the business leaders, instead absorbing their points of view and, at times, promising to think about their arguments. It's probably also helpful that he has said that there is a very important role to be played by the private sector when it comes to addressing NYC's housing crisis. Among those who have sat down with the would-be mayor are James Whelan, the president of the Real Estate Board of New York, who Mamdani cold-called and asked for a meeting, real estate manager Jeffrey Gurl, Pfizer executive Sally Sussman, and Michael Bloomberg and his longtime advisor Howard Wolfson. He's also reportedly spoken briefly with J.P. Morgan's CEO Jamie Dimon and discussed economic policy with former UBS America's CEO Robert Wolf. "I don't want him to fail," Gural told The Times, also saying that Mamdani came off as personable and smart. Gural maintained that he still plans to vote for Andrew Cuomo. Sussman similarly called the candidate smart and a good listener, noting that he picks up on things. Meanwhile, Wolfson, who maintained that Mamdani would not get his vote, described the Democratic Socialist as intelligent and engaged and engaging, adding that he also asks good questions. He avoids unnecessary argument. According to Wolfson, the former mayor was equally impressed by the candidate. Zoran has made clear that he's willing to meet with anyone, including those who disagree with him, to advance his affordability agenda, a spokeswoman for Mamdani told The Times. Meanwhile, as the ruling classes make their peace with Mamdani, his popularity continues to spread. The online astrologer Chaney Nicholas appeared in a video this week wearing a New York Jews for Zoran t-shirt, while the Hot Girls for Zoran group is hosting a number of events this month in support of the candidate. This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from VanityFair.com. Thank you for listening, and have a great week, everybody.